Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Today, an empowering hour. We're going to find out how we can do a lot to protect our health, especially from cervical cancer, by making sure that we plant in our lawn a particular type of garden weed. Yeah, so summer lawn weed can help protect you against cervical cancer. Heilongjiang Reclamation University in China, published in the BMC's Complementary and Alternative Medicine. Also today, I'm going to continue with addressing what I consider one of the most important current articles by any journalist in the United States. I started yesterday, Matt Taibbi in Rolling Stone. I will continue today, and it's called "The American Press is Destroying Itself." And I will be reading some of it, then I'm going to take an aside to explain from my perspective why I think this is so important. I'm also starting today, over the next 4 weeks, every day, I'm going to be playing outside individuals who I respect, their positioning of how did we get here? How did we get, for example, teenagers out there screaming at the police, hurling every type of invective and bombast at them, as if these people are just police. They're machines. They don't have feelings. You have over 800,000 police. You have some that are simply incapable of serving and protecting the public, who are menace to society. What percentage are these? A small percent. What percent protect those? Again, a relatively small percent. So what does it show about you when you communicate only through terror in your voice and in your words and denunciations and accusations? You don't know who that person is. Now, what if that person were gone, taken away? What if we took all the police out of Chicago, New York City, Camden, Compton, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Miami? No police, just like you want, just like you say it's right to do. What do you think would happen? Well, in Chicago last week, they had 107 more or less shootings. People were actually shot. Over 12 people died, and several were children. Imagine what the numbers would be. Imagine the break-ins, the robberies, the rapes. But evidently, in the people who are currently controlling the narrative, the woke generation, who becomes a victim of their foolishness and irresponsible attitude is irrelevant. They have the media on their side, so nothing they say or do is going to be condemned. We're going to deal with that. But I'm not going to deal with it. You're going to hear some other people deal with it. And then in the second part of our program, we have Mark Crispin Miller. He's a professor of media, culture, and communications at New York University, where he specializes in modern propaganda, history of advertising, and film and mainstream media. He is also the lead chief editor of the series Forbidden Bookshelf at Open Road Media, which republishes important books that have been censored or banned or ignored or wrongly criticized in the course of American history, such works as I.F. Stone and Lewis Mumford and Peter Dale Scott and Christopher Simpson and others. And he received his master's and doctorate at John Hopkins University. And now he's being attacked. So we're going to talk about the conspiracy theory as neoliberal propaganda. So you see, we have a lot to share. We begin always with the latest on health and healing. And in that respect, we have to look at a simple plant. It's delicious, by the way. You find it used all the time in the Mediterranean. It's called purslane. P-U-R-S-L-A-N-E. It's a common green. It's a little crunchy. It's kind of, it has a nice crunchy quality to it. Something like a cucumber and how the mouthfeel of it. And it's moist inside and just a slightly bitter taste. Delicious in salads. Well, purslane is used to remove toxic heat and substance from the body in traditional Chinese medicine. It's also used to treat dysentery and eczema, hemorrhoidal bleeding, and abnormal uterine bleeding. But in a recent study at two different hospitals and universities in China, purslane also was shown to be effective against cervical cancer, specifically a polysaccharide, which is a carbohydrate, in purslane can inhibit the death of dendritic cells, which are important immune cells for stopping the growth of tumors. So that's good information. And you can find purslane almost every week at the farmer's market. All right, so try that. From the University of Melbourne, which is in Australia, they found that omega-3 fatty acid supplements improve peripheral nerve health. Well, just imagine how many tens of millions of Americans have peripheral nerve damage from a lot of reasons, and including diabetes, the neuropathy in diabetes. And so they found that the omega-3 fatty acids go to work inside your body and help that. So once again, if you have peripheral nerve damage, the omega-3 fatty acids can help. Also from Arizona State University comes a study published in Psychological Science that for some children, screen time before bed translates to less sleep. It's not only that, but a lot of kids today want to be in constant communication at any hour. So they sleep with their cell phone or their tablet or computer on all night, frequently right under their pillow or right beside their head. Now that's throwing an electromagnetic frequency pulse right into the brain. And we're seeing an increase in cancers due to that. Now this is before G5, before G4, before G3. So we have been exposing young people's very sensitive skulls and brains to very toxic levels of electromagnetic frequency. But add into that now this Arizona Department of Psychology used the hour preceding bedtime to see what would be the impact on children's kids' sleep, especially children who struggle to self-regulate their behavior. By the way, if you wonder where all those screaming kids in the shopping carts are when they're going through and the mother's just, father's just worn out and trying to calm them, and whatever they scream that they want, they're given. And you wonder, what the hell ever happens to those when they grow up? Take a look in the streets. Those are a lot of those kids. They had no discipline. Well, among kids who used the same amount of media in the hour before bed, there was a substantial difference in a personality characteristic called effortful control. Effortful control just means that they don't care what you're telling them to do. They're going to do what they want to do. And they're easily distracted, and they can't keep on point easily. So if we want kids to end up with poor immune systems and be vulnerable, don't let them sleep. And this is one thing that they're not doing. From the Swiss Institute for Experimental Cancer comes a research published in eLife that blocking sugar metabolism slows lung tumor growth. So this is a new finding, suggests treatments that block two sugar-transporting proteins could help slow the growth of lung tumors. That's important, and that could save some lives or prolong lives. Why? It's simple. Cancer cells use a lot of sugar to fuel their rapid growth and spread. This has led scientists to consider cutting off their sugar supply as a way to treat cancer. The current studies suggest that this could be an effective approach, but it will be necessary to block multiple pathways at once to be effective. Now, proteins called glucose transporters supply sugar to cells, making them an appealing target for therapies intended to starve cancer cells. But scientists don't know the best ways to do this, or if cancer cells would just switch to alternative fuel sources if they are denied sugar. So inhibiting sugar in use in lung tumors could be an efficient treatment strategy, and that's according to the Dr. Kontat, who is the head of this study. So get the sugar out of your diet, and especially don't allow anyone who has cancers of any type to have any processed sugars whatsoever. And also from Northumbria University, which is in the United Kingdom, rosemary essential oil can enhance working memory in children. This is a groundbreaking research. A team of researchers from Northumbria University demonstrated that the aroma of rosemary essential oil can enhance mental performance in children. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal of British Psychological Society and given at their annual conference. Now, we know that there are all types of essential oils that can help. Lavender, 2 drops of lavender put on your pillow before you go to bed, enhances your sleep. Lemongrass is invigorating. Sandalwood, that's calming. So there's all types of these aromas. So look into them. But this is just one that is good. And by the way, they also have antimicrobial effects too. Dermatologists, for instance, use the essential oils of rosemary to treat acne and bacterial skin infections. So what it does, it keeps improving brain function. And that's what essential oils do. That's why we should have some at home. And also from Zhengzhou University in China, they did a study about homocysteine metabolism. Well, elevated homocysteine, when you're up around 14, 15, 16, 17, you're at a greater risk of a heart attack or stroke, and it's a silent killer. But how do you get rid of it? Bring it down. Vitamin B complex, 25 milligrams of B1, 2, 6, folic acid, and vitamin B12 and vitamin C all bring homocysteine down. That's why you should be having those on a regular basis and protect yourself. And from Wageningen University in the Netherlands, cacao, which is raw chocolate, green tea can slash your heart attack disease death risk by 40%. I said 40%. So long-term consumption of the epicatechin, that's a compound found in green tea, and by the way, it's also in apples and apple skin, and cacao, made significant benefits in boosting heart health and reducing the risk of heart-related death. And this was a big study. They collected data over 25 years. And so in our country, we don't drink green tea very often. Some people do, but most don't. We don't eat raw chocolate. We eat this highly processed, over-sugared dairy chocolate. And we generally are not big on looking for specific functional foods like an apple. We eat an apple because we like the taste of an apple. But now we have to start looking at how the food that we eat enhances our long-term survival and prevents disease. If you peeled the skin off 4 apples and put them in a blender each day, put some green tea in that, and then put a piece of chocolate, like a 2-inch square of raw chocolate in there, that would be a great heart benefit. I mean, that would just be terrific. Now, of course, if you drank that down at the same time you took your L-carnitine, coenzyme Q10, magnesium, cayenne, you would have, and vitamin E, you would have much less chance of having a heart attack or stroke. I'm Gary Nall. We're 14 minutes into our program. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to go directly to a little tape. It's why public schools and mainstream media dumb us down, because it is my belief that everything that we're seeing now is orchestrated. They're using unfortunate acts of violence to justify their agenda. And I believe that agenda is to get Joe Biden, who is irrelevant to them. It's abuse against an elderly person. If you look at it realistically, he has no capability intellectually or physically in being president of anything, not even a retirement home. But it's the people like Kamala Harris and others who are just waiting to get power, because then you've got Hillary Clinton on steroids. And don't count Hillary Clinton out. She may be coming in at the end to, quote, save the party. We'll see. But now by having a whole if you don't believe us, you're a racist group, and having utter promotion by all the media, $100 million coming to it from the Ford Foundation, another $100 million through George Soros' efforts and then tens of millions of dollars, you're talking about an enormous amount of money. That's not going to help de-ghettoize any place where blacks live. That's not going to be helping all other people of color. That's not going to be helping the poor, white or any other color. That's not going to go to stop crime, but it is going to be used to have more power and to dictate what is right and what is wrong and what you can say, what you can't say, what you can't even think. And boy, will we have a divided society at that point. How did we get here? How did they get this mindless people running amok, wanting to do things without thinking through them? This is one of the 30 different talks that you're going to hear that can help better explain it. Back in a moment.
Once fully enslaved, no nation, state, city of this earth ever afterward resumes its liberty. These were the words of caution which the great poet Walter Whitman offered to his fellow Americans. For Whitman recognized that crucial to a free and flourishing society are men and women who are willing to question and even resist authority when necessary. But today, very few of us live by the ideal espoused by Whitman. Rather, blind obedience is the norm. We have become populations of sheep, easily to be herded into the chains of tyranny. But what has led those of us in the West to largely shun the advice of Whitman? In this video, we will examine two institutions that have played an integral role in the breeding of a passive citizenry: the compulsory state-run education system, which in North America is called the public school system, and the mainstream media. Public schooling is viewed as one of the shining lights of the modern Western world. Who could question the value of an institution that provides free and compulsory education for all? But as with many institutions of our day, the textbook picture of how the institution should work greatly diverges from the reality of how it does work. If public schools taught individuals how to think, if they promoted intellectual curiosity and produced citizens healthy in body and mind, then few would question their value. Bureaucrats that run this institution, a darker reality emerges. Or as John Taylor Gatto, a former teacher turned one of public schooling's greatest critics, writes, "Schools are intended to produce formulaic human beings whose behavior can be predicted and controlled. To a very great extent, schools succeed in doing this, but in a national order in which the only successful people are independent, self-reliant, confident, and individualistic, the products of schooling are irrelevant. Well-schooled people are irrelevant. They can sell film and razor blades, push paper and talk on telephones, or sit mindlessly before a flickering computer terminal. But as human beings, they are useless. Useless to others and useless to themselves." Noam Chomsky echoed this sentiment, writing in his book Understanding Power, "Given the external power structure of the society in which they function, the institutional role of the schools, for the most part, is just to train people for obedience and conformity, and to make them controllable and indoctrinated." To some, this may sound like heresy, but a study of history reveals that this was the intention from the very start. The state-run school systems in the West were modeled off the factory style of education first introduced in Prussia in the early 1700s. "What shocks," writes Gatto, "is that we should so eagerly have adopted one of the very worst aspects of Prussian culture, an educational system deliberately designed to produce mediocre intellects, to hamstring the inner life, to deny students appreciable leadership skills, and to ensure docile and incomplete citizens, all in order to render the populace manageable." Albert Einstein, an individual who reached heights of genius rarely seen, did not credit his compulsory schooling with his intellectual development. Reflecting back on his school years, Einstein noted that after completing his final examinations, his interest in the field he would go on to revolutionize was all but dead. "I found the consideration of scientific problems," he wrote, "distasteful to me for an entire year." Einstein believed that one of the major flaws of compulsory, state-run education systems is their forced style of teaching. "It is, in fact, nothing short of a miracle," he wrote, "that the modern methods of instruction have not yet entirely strangled the holy curiosity of inquiry. It is a very grave mistake to think that the enjoyment of seeing and searching can be promoted by means of coercion and a sense of duty." After well over a decade of indoctrination in the school system, few emerge with a great thirst for knowledge and a curiosity toward the many mysteries of the world. Instead, as Bruce Levine writes in his book Resisting Illegitimate Authority, by the time a student graduates, they have been bred to be passive, to be directed by others, to take seriously the rewards and punishments of authority, to pretend to care about things that they do not care about, and that one is impotent to change one's dissatisfying situation.
All right, that's a point of view and a perspective, and let me just mention a few anti-authoritarian figures throughout history. Voltaire was certainly one, but Mahatma Gandhi was one, Martin Luther King was one, and we have Malcolm X as one. These are just some. And what we have to appreciate is there are two approaches. One is to try to make change in those who have power over us and are abusing their power, and that's virtually all the people who've been in power since Ronald Reagan. And so what we have to do is, how do we challenge them in a nonviolent way? Because you can. And because if you do it nonviolently, but you do it intelligently, then your goal is not to isolate and fragment segments of society to fight against each other. Rather, it is to show what is wrong with the overarching power structures that now exist. So you boycott, you start going off their grid. You no longer use their credit cards. You no longer buy your clothes in their stores, and their clothes that they bought, that you're now wearing, come from women who've been exploited in Bangladesh and India and other countries. You no longer buy their genetically modified commercial foods. You no longer watch their television programs or no longer read their newspapers. You no longer support them in elections. You look for the third party, fourth party, fifth party candidates that truly represent the people, who are not being influenced by money or favors. This is how you do it. It takes time and organization. And as long as we have 3.5% of the public working together, the empowered minority can make an enormous change in what we're doing. And we can do it without burning buildings, without looting, without beating people up or killing people. We can do it in civil discourse. Now, I've led hundreds of demonstrations. I participated in hundreds more. My activism goes back over 53 years, and it's been nonstop. Never once had I get out there and scream in someone's face or denounce someone. And yet we won time and again because we were measured in what we did and we looked at what the average person would support, because it's not the person in power who's paying attention to you. They don't care. It's the person who is sitting quietly watching who is going to be the determining factor. That's why I said 200,000-300,000 angry people in the streets, angry and rightly so, about another person being killed who should not have been, again, rightly so, and then torching a whole neighborhood, not all the protesters, but a lot of them did, and looters and rioters, and torching whose neighborhood? Whose small businesses? People of color, people, working class people, all their life savings there, no insurance to cover any of these losses. Can you name me one of their names? Can you tell me what it's like now when they have no store to go to, no savings, and only debt? A life destroyed by someone who didn't think about who the enemy is. Just lashing out, tearing down all the statues. This is the next thing. Okay, then do it democratically. Let everyone have a say-so and then put it up for a vote. Yeah. For example, why is there such hypocrisy in this? Because if you're going to be honest, at the top of the list of one of the most avowed racist in history of the United States was Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood. Now, whatever your views on Planned Parenthood, that's your business. It's your body, it's your right, and I'm not going to tell you what to do, positive or negative. That's not my right. That's why I never talk about sex, politics, or religion, because whatever your views, they're your views. But what I will say is for them not to challenge Margaret Sanger, not to use her as the number one example, she's a female version of Andrew Jackson, who was a rampant racist, Trail of Tears. Anyhow, what don't you know? Well, go out on the street and ask the average person who's protesting, what do you know about Margaret Sanger? Now, her Wikipedia is squeaky clean with nothing controversial about her. But then again, Wikipedia, in my opinion, is just a propaganda tool for special interests in the deep state. There's nothing about it I would ever support. Here's what you have to understand. She popularized the term birth control and opened up in the opening of the first birth control clinic, only staffed by women physicians in the U.S., that later evolved into Planned Parenthood in 1921. And to her credit, she wanted to prevent back alley abortions, and I support that, because who wants to see someone who feels they have no other choice and ends up hurting themselves and could kill themselves and have with a back alley abortion? She started the diaphragm, which no one would make in the United States, and the government was confiscating, so she had it made in Japan. Also, she was a member of the women's wing of the Socialist Party and fought for labor rights, hanging out with John Reed and Upton St. Clair and Emma Goldman. When she was prosecuted in 1914 for her book, Family Limitation, which promoted her philosophy, she fled to the United Kingdom. Now, she actually worked with African-American leaders such as James Hubert and W.E.D. Du Bois, and because she saw the need for birth control education in the black communities with high teenage pregnancies. And Martin Luther King, who received the Margaret Sanger Award, praised her work fighting racism. That's the part the public knows. But what you don't know is that Margaret Sanger also said, quote, "We do not want word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population," end quote. Quote, "If it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members," end quote. In her own book in 1922, Pivot of Civilization, Margaret Sanger wrote about blacks and immigrants as, quote, "as human weeds, reckless breeders, spawning human beings who never should have been born," end quote. Also in the same book, quote, "we are paying for and submitting to an ever-increasing, unceasingly spawning class of human beings who never should have been born at all, that our wealth is being diverted from the progress of human civilization. Our eyes should be open to the terrific cost to the community of this dead weight of human waste," end quote. She's talking about blacks, all right? In her 1938 autobiography, quote, "I accepted an invitation to talk to the women's branch of the Ku Klux Klan. I saw through the door dim figures parading with banners and illuminated crosses. I was escorted to the platform. I was introduced and began to speak. In the end, through simple illustrations explaining the problems of inferior races, I believed I had accomplished my purpose. A dozen invitations to speak to similar groups were proffered," end quote. She supported the Ku Klux Klan. She worked with the Ku Klux Klan. She was one of the leading voices for eugenics, as is Bill Gates today. She found an agreement with other eugenicists, especially with the Havelock Ellis from the British Eugenic Society of her time, because both sought to help the human race eliminate those who were, quote, unfit. So she divided humanity into groups, those who were educated, informed, and responsible, and those who were, quote, irresponsible and reckless, often due to religious scruples, which she attacked. This is the group she discouraged procreation. She wrote in 1921, quote, "The purpose of promoting birth control was to create a race of thoroughbreds," end quote. And 2 years earlier stated, quote, "more children from the fit and less from the unfit is the chief aim of birth control." In her essay entitled "We Must Breed a Race of Thoroughbreds," she argued her Planned Parenthood clinics should be established, quote, "to breed out of the race the scourges of transmissible disease, mental defects, poverty, lawlessness, and crime, since these classes would be decreasing in number instead of breeding like weeds," end quote. But selective breeding was also advocated by Winston Churchill and Hubert Hoover and Theodore Roosevelt and George Bernard Shaw and H.G. Wells. These were all eugenicists. She believed that for the purpose of racial purification, couples should be rewarded if they chose to be sterilized. She advocated in 1932 that couples be required to submit an application to the government agency to have a child. And she felt in her book, 1932, Plan for Peace, Sanger outlined her strategy to eradicate those she deemed feeble-minded and with compulsory sterilization and segregation to a lifetime of farm work. And so those are just a tiny fraction of what she did that makes her one of the most formidable races. So why isn't there condemnation of her? And why aren't you wanting to remove her statues? And also, let us understand that we had a lot of people who signed the Declaration of Independence. There were 55 delegates to the Constitutional Convention. 49% owned slaves. From Richard Bassett. And by the way, Jacob Broom and William Houston and John Samuel Johnson, these people owned slaves. And other slave owners opposed slavery and supported abolition, Jacob Brown and William Samuel Johnson. Of the 26 slave owners, 19 owned multiple slaves and relied upon slave labor for their livelihood. All told, at least 12 presidents of the United States, a quarter of all American presidents, enslaved people during their lifetimes. Of these, 8 held enslaved people while they were in the White House. Enslaved laborers helped build the White House. Therefore, if you're going to be pure to your philosophy, don't just take down the statue of Andrew Jackson across the street from the White House. Take down the White House. In fact, eliminate the White House except as a museum based upon its slavery and the occupants, the 12 presidents who owned slaves. That would be something. And by the way, all the earliest presidents except John Adams and his son John Quincy Adams owned enslaved. And George Washington kept some 300 bondsmen at his Mount Vernon plantation. James Madison, James Monroe, Andrew Jackson each kept several dozen enslaved workers. James Madison, who never made any public anti-slavery efforts, is quoted as telling his overseer to be kind and compassionate to his slaves, but he didn't free them. William Henry Harrison owned several inherited slaves, and he became president in 1841. John Tyler, James Polk, both enslavers during their stints in office. Zachary Taylor, who served from 1849 to 1850, was the last chief executive to keep enslaved people while living in the White House. He owned 150 enslaved plantation workers in Kentucky, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Andrew Johnson, who served as Lincoln's vice president before he became president in 1865, upon Lincoln's death, had owned at least a half a dozen enslaved. And the last president to personally own enslaved people was Ulysses S. Grant, who served 2 terms from 1869 to 1877. He kept a lone black enslaved man named William Jones, but gave him his freedom in 1859. So you see, there is legitimacy in concern about what has been done, but it's also how you approach it. Instead of burning down and tearing down these, create a video history of the truth, both positive and negative, about each one of these institutions and monuments, and then put it up to a vote. Put it up for on all the local people can have a say-so. Because if you're not going to be hypocritical, then you've got to shut down the White House and no longer to be inhabited, and then have real historians write the true history of how it was built and who occupied it and how many of them owned slaves. And the same would be true for all other institutions. That would also mean closing down Central Park. That would mean building the recreation of what was torn down in the 1800s when African Americans owned property there. So you see, once you open this door, understand that if you just go through in anger and tear things down without public discourse, without debate, then you're just going to get a backlash on this. Just some thoughts. We're going to go to my guest, Professor Mark Crispin Miller, in a moment, but I just want to bring on a woman named, her name is Brandy Parfums. She is a former contributing editor, Horse Directory Magazine. She's a writer and a part of the Equine Information Center. Nice to have you with us today, Patricia.
Hello, Gary. My name is Patty.
Oh, okay. I just have Patricia here. Yeah. Patty, you dug into the history of the artists who designed and caused to be built, the statue in front of the Museum of Natural History of Teddy Roosevelt and the Native American and the indigenous, or the African and the indigenous person at his side. Tell us about who he was, since people who want to take that down may not know the artist or his interpretation and his creation of that statue.
Yes, there was an exhibit in the museum that only had one tiny quote from James Earl Fraser, and he was a classic realist sculptor. They didn't really explain his own thoughts about the Teddy Roosevelt statue, so I'd like to tell you a little of his background. He was born in 1876 in Winona, Minnesota, and then raised in South Dakota. He was taught to carve in wood from a Native American, and he saw the West changing and the Native Americans being driven off their land by business interests and also the railroad, and it upset him greatly, and he respected Native Americans. And then he studied in Chicago and Paris, and that gave him a classical education. He also sculpted as an assistant for Saint-Gaudens, the Sherman Grand Army Plaza sculpture that is considered probably the best sculpture in New York City. And Saint-Gaudens recommended him to do a bust of Teddy Roosevelt for the Senate. And when he finished that bust, Saint-Gaudens commented it was equal to the best things of the Renaissance. So he was a highly respected sculptor in his day. And this commission came in 1939, and then the piece debuted at the museum in 1940. And it was made to fill the large arch, so it had to have three figures instead of one. And it was the idea for the commission was handed to him to have Teddy mounted on a horse with a Native American and an African. So he then did his research. By the way, many of his pieces are in Washington, D.C., so there's quite a bit that he did, including pieces in front of the Supreme Court. Now, he has quite a bit to say about his own work, and this is what he said about the Teddy Roosevelt piece. I'm going to read you from his notes. Theodore Roosevelt in this equestrian statue is shown not as the president of the United States, but as a naturalist who made a notable collection of animal specimens from Africa and America. Roosevelt rides forth with his always dynamic and highly enthusiastic manner. The two figures at his side are, and now he crosses out in his notes, symbols and he writes guides of the continents of Africa and America, and if you choose, may stand for Roosevelt's friendliness to all races. The mass of the group necessarily is powerful, both to fill the opening of the arch and to be adequate to the scale of the architecture. The horse has the approximate proportions of man-of-war, not as the racer, but the fully grown stallion. The monument is 16 feet high and is one of the largest equestrians in the world. About the horse, Fraser's more specific, and he says...
Hold on. We don't have time for that.
Okay.
At any place in his writings, did you find anything that represent racism or bigotry in his thoughts about what he was doing?
Nothing. And that is perhaps why the museum didn't present what he thought, because they had their own agenda.
Okay. So in your mind, this is more political than...
I believe it is. And there is something else important. The city wants to remove the sculpture, but that's going to be very difficult due to its weight and size. And it'll probably be damaged, and for sure the plinth will be destroyed. And that is something to consider. Moving large works of art is not easy. And there was a professor, James Beck, who wrote a Bill of Rights for a work of art in 2007, and you can still read that on ArtWatch. It's very dangerous, tricky business.
I agree. Thank you very much, Patricia, for sharing that with us, because the people wanting to tear these pieces, these arts down because they believe it represents racism, are not interested in preserving them. They're interested in destroying them as symbols. And I just think that they should think well what they're doing. And now they want to, you know, they want to take down Abraham Lincoln's. And if it weren't for Lincoln, you would have had slavery continue. There's no deep thinking in this. There's no real sense of history. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary.
We're going to go to Mark Kristen Miller in just one moment. I just want to mention two quick things. This Sunday, my webinar is already filled up, and now I have no more room. I'll try to get more room. If we can get more bandwidth than my 1 o'clock webinar on where to move in America, around the world, to get out of the cities and have a better quality of life, have new careers, be around progressive people, which are the best places. I've been working on this for months and months and months. All the people in the webinar will receive the lists, and these are long lists of everything that you would ever need to make a move and start your life over again in a better way and away from the cesspools that become New York City and all the other major cities and all their corruption and crime. When I do have that, you'll go to prn.fm and see how to sign up. But as of right this moment, I don't have any more room. We're packed. Also, we've been out of nitric cell stuff for a while. I'm sorry. We just got it in this morning. Not a lot. What no one realized about the coronavirus is they're strangling the amount of materials that you can get. And a lot of companies have gone out of business. They just can't get raw materials. And because mine are so high quality and so varied, we had to go everywhere to get even a small batch. So it's only one per customer. But this has got the beets and the pomegranates and the cacao and the grapes and blueberries and the organic prunes and goji berries and acai berry and rhubarb and spinach and kale and watercress and celery and cilantro and spirulina and lemon, grapefruit, orange, and watermelon. This is what actually helps the body create nitric oxide. One of the single most important things you could do, if not the single most important thing you can do to help yourself, if you only, and I don't have time now to go through what nitric oxide does, increasing blood flow, etc. But what each pomegranate beets do to the arteries and to the epithelia of the arteries, that you can read up on your own. It's just want to let you know, I'm sorry we've been out. We just got it in this morning. And we'll probably be out in about 3 or 4 days, but at least you have a chance to call in if you want to get one jar. That's it. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Now let's go over and say hello to my guest, Professor Mark Kristen Miller. I gave you his bio earlier on at the beginning of the show, and his website is Mark Kristen, that's C-R-I-S-P-I-N, Miller.com. Mark Kristen Miller. Nice to have you with us today, Mark.
Hi.
Mark, today the term conspiracy theory has become a household expression and is being frequently used as a means to differentiate so-called real news from fake news. And we know from history there have been proven conspiracies penetrating our government and corporate America, like the Gulf of Tonkin, the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty, Operation Ajax, when the CIA hired Iranians to pose as communists to stage its coup against Mossadegh, Operation Northwood, the assassination of Martin Luther King, that attorney Bill Pepper has seemed to prove without any question of doubt, and many others. We barely question any of these today. Yet today, conspiracy theory has taken on a derogatory meaning, and bad and nonsensical reports are being called conspiratorial just as investigations that find some evidence contrary to an official position. And since today everything official is controlled by the mainstream media and they have their own agenda, then how do we know what is real and how do we know what is fake? And especially now, since they've also attacked you for trying to educate the public about what is real and what is fake, the forum is yours.
Well, thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me on. It's true that the phrase conspiracy theory has long since been internalized. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that we've all internalized it. it's being used, or I should say deployed now, against people who, for example, question the natural origin scenario for the coronavirus. There is, in fact, copious evidence that this virus was enhanced through what they call gain-of-function research to be more infectious to human beings. But to say so, publicly is to invite condemnation as a conspiracy theorist by outlets like the New York Times, the Times in Britain, which attacked me personally, just for sharing with my list a piece on the likelihood of the coronavirus having been, you know, engineered, a piece by Francis Boyle, who's an authority on this kind of thing. Just for circulating that piece, I was lumped in together with a number of friends and colleagues who study propaganda, and the implication was that I was putting people at risk simply by suggesting that the coronavirus was evidently engineered as a bioweapon. Whether it was released deliberately or by accident, we cannot yet know. So all the examples that you cited are indeed excellent examples of real conspiracies that have occurred throughout America's post-war history. But I think it's crucial that we focus on its continued deployment right now to chill discussion of or investigation into quite a wide range of apparent conspiracies. But the internalization of that meme conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorist, you know, as pejorative terms, inhibits a lot of people from looking into these matters for themselves. And that's the purpose of the original weaponization of the phrase, conspiracy theory. Now, what many people still don't know is that the phrase conspiracy theory had been used in American journalism for, you know, a century or so by 1967. So it's not as if the CIA invented the phrase. What the CIA did in 1967 was to send all of its station chiefs worldwide a memo. It is memo 1035-960. You can go and find it online. This was the CIA's response to the growing interest of the American people in critiques of the Warren Commission report on President Kennedy's assassination. There were people like Mark Lane, Sylvia Mayer, and others had written really incisive and persuasive critiques of the Warren Commission report as, well, let's be charitable and say that it raised more questions than it answered. The memo does not mention the fact that James Garrison in New Orleans had begun a legal action charging Clay Shaw and unnamed co-conspirators in planning the assassination of the president. Garrison was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson and kind of took that show away from Carson. It's really a remarkable example of the power of lucidity and logic and reason, you know, to persuade people to rethink what they'd been told. At any rate, the memo instructed all the CIA station chiefs worldwide to use their propaganda assets and friends in the media to discredit the work of these conspiracy theorists by writing pieces that would use one or more of five or six what we would call talking points today. So what the CIA did with this memo was, in a word, to weaponize that phrase, which, you know, if you go back and you look at in the archives of the New York Times or the Washington Post or Time magazine, you find that that phrase starts to be used often in mid to late 1967, and then is used increasingly over the years, you know, through the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, through 9/11, through Iran-Contra, through the election thefts by Bush-Cheney in 2000 and 2004. It has been so widely and reflexively deployed by Western journalists, not just American journalists, that it has actually succeeded in changing the way the American people think about elite power, okay? How many times have you heard somebody say, well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but, okay? And then they'll articulate a perfectly reasonable suspicion or calculation, you know, or speculation that, you know, you have to be sort of brain dead not to see as reasonable. So I think we can consider the CIA's deployment of the phrase conspiracy theory and the epithet conspiracy theorist as one of the most successful propaganda drives in human history, because the American people not only started to, you know, distrust their own intuitions about elite power, but they actually had their views of elite power changed by this propaganda drive, because as a matter of fact, the American people had, you know, from the founding of the Republic all the way up into the middle of the 20th century, they had always taken a healthily, sanely, suspicious view of elite intentions. I mean, it's only natural for the citizens of a democracy or a republic to be suspicious of the motives and intentions of elites. There's nothing crazy about that. In fact, if anything, it's crazy not to harbor such suspicions. Read the Declaration of Independence. That's a conspiracy theory from beginning to end. And there are other examples, you know, from the ensuing couple of centuries that make quite clear that Americans didn't have a problem suspecting that elites might be up to no good. Well, it's only human nature for the elites to be up to no good. They look out for their own interests. They want to increase their wealth and power. They want to inhibit the public from rebelling or questioning things. So, you know, now that it's regarded as sort of insane to suspect conspiracies at very high levels, the people have been somewhat incapacitated at dealing with you know, political reality. Just one case in point, you know, is Bill Gates. Bill Gates was a monopolist who used illegal tactics to build, you know, Microsoft and make himself a fortune of some $50 billion. The government sued him. Right after he settled that suit, he formed founded the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has doubled his wealth. You know, he now has $100 billion since starting the foundation and has demonstrably devoted himself to projects that are lethal, that have had lethal consequences. His vaccine program, his devotion to geoengineering, his involvement with Monsanto, and the, you know, creation of GMO seeds. He has just begun working on the creation of artificial breast milk. He's interested in lab-grown meat. His vaccine programs have killed or disabled countless Africans and Asians. This is all, you know, a matter of public record, although it's a public record people don't really know because it's buried. What is unreasonable about suspecting Bill Gates' motives? You know, the son of two ardent eugenicists, someone who has himself said repeatedly that the goal of his vaccination programs is to reduce population. He tries to represent this as a kind of a green program, but it isn't, you know. His views and Margaret Sanger's views, which you were articulating a moment ago, are very similar. And yet Bill Gates is treated as kind of a saint, you know. I call him Father Teresa because he used his foundation not only to increase his wealth, but to sanitize his image, exactly as John D. Rockefeller had done before him, right?
Mark, we're running out of time.
Okay.
I'm going to invite you back for a full hour for our Progressive Commentary Hour, because I believe that what we're seeing today is not spontaneous. I believe that behind so many negative things happening are a group of people who need to control the outcome of everything in a country. They control the media. They control corporate interests. They're part of corporate interest. And they have to control the people. And they have failed at doing that in the past. Look at the last 3.5 years of Russia. Anyone who was up on their facts knew that Russia didn't hack the DNC. It was Mark. It was a gentleman who worked there and who took the documents, handed them to Murray in the park across from George Washington University. And Ray McGovern and Bill Blenning, all those national security and CIA analysts, agreed with that. They came out with that statement,
right.
And yet the media would not touch that, would not interview any of them, and said, continue with this myth. They're also in control of the coronavirus. They've mismanaged every part of this. They've lied constantly to us about how lethal it is, how easy it is to be infected, and what the treatment should be, disavowing anything that's natural to prevent the disease, only focusing upon the new miracle drugs and the new vaccines. And now all of these riots, and of course they're all about gaining power. For whom? Who's going to gain power? What's going to be reversed? And I just see a connection between all this right now, and I believe that we should pay attention to it and have this discussion, okay?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, I think that what we've been living through since January is what you might call a 1-2 punch. There's abundant evidence that what's been happening at the street level throughout the country is being engineered. You know, righteous protests have been hijacked, used to, on the one hand, demonstrate. I mean, these protests have been depicted as good by the media, you know, as opposed to the protests against the lockdowns a few months before, which are depicted as evil and bad and destructive. Meanwhile, these protests have been accompanied by rampant vandalism and arson and physical violence against human beings. And the police oddly refrained from interfering with that while beating the tar out of protesters and journalists. You can't look at something like this and not try to put the dots together, you know,
well,
connect them.
Mark, we will do this on our next program, but I'm sorry we're way over our schedule
right
now. Professor Mark Crispin Miller, stay tuned. Right behind us, Utrecht Lead.